The High Lady Suroth Sabel Meldareth lay awake on her bed, staring up at the ceiling. The moon was down, and the triple-arched windows that overlooked a palace garden were dark, but her eyes had adjusted so that she could make out at least the outlines of the ornate, painted plasterwork. Dawn was no more than an hour or two off, yet she had not slept. She had lain awake most nights since Tuon vanished, sleeping only when exhaustion closed her eyes, however hard she tried to keep them open. Sleep brought nightmares she wished she could forget. Ebudar was never truly cold, but the night held a little coolness, enough to keep her awake, lying beneath only a thin silk sheet. The question that tainted her dreams was simple and stark. Was Tuon alive or dead? The escape of the Atha Anmier Damani and Queen Tylin's murder spoke in favor of her death. Three events of that magnitude happening on one night by chance was pressing coincidence too far, and the first two were horrifying enough in themselves to indicate the worst for Tuon. Someone was trying to sow fear among the Hriagel, those who come home, perhaps to disrupt the entire return. How better to achieve that than to assassinate Tuon? Worse, it had to be one of their own. Because she had landed under the veil, no local knew who Tuon was. Tylin had surely been killed with the One Power, by Isuldam and her Damani. Suroth had leaped at the suggestion that Aes Sedai were to blame, yet eventually someone who mattered would question how one of those women could enter a palace full of Damani, in a city full of Damani, and escape detection. At least one Suldam had been necessary to uncollar the sea folk Damani, and two of her own Suldam had disappeared at almost the same time. In any case, they had been noticed as missing 2 days later, and no one had seen them since the night Tuon vanished. She did not believe they were involved, though they had been in the kennels. For one thing, she could not imagine Renna or Sita uncollaring a Damani. They certainly had reasons enough to sneak away and seek employment far off, with someone ignorant of their filthy secret. Someone like this Aginan Tamaroth, who had stolen a pair of a Damani. Strange that, for one newly raised to the blood. Strange, but unimportant. She could see no way to tie it to the rest. Likely the woman had found the stresses and complexities of nobility too much for a simple sailor. Well, she would be found and arrested eventually. The important fact, the potentially deadly fact, was that Renna and Sita were gone, and no one could say exactly when they had left. If the wrong person noted their departure so close to the critical time and made the wrong calculation, she pressed the heels of her hands against her eyes and exhaled softly, very near to a groan. Even should she escape suspicion of murdering Tuon, if the woman was dead, then she herself would be required to apologize to the Empress, might she live forever. For the death of the acknowledged heir to the Crystal Throne, her apology would be protracted, and as painful as it was humiliating. It might end with her execution, or much worse, with being sent to the block as property. Not that it would actually come to that, though in her nightmares it often did. Her hand slid beneath the pillows to touch the unsheathed dagger there. The blade was little longer than her hand, yet more than sharp enough to open her veins, preferably in a warm bath. If time came for an apology, she would not live to reach Shondar. The dishonor to her name might even be lessened a little if enough people believed the act was itself an apology. She would leave a letter explaining it, so that might help. Still, there was a chance Tuon remained alive, and Suroth clung to it. Killing her and spiriting the body away might be a deep move ordered from Shanchan by one of her surviving sisters who coveted the throne. Yet Tuon had arranged her own disappearance more than once. In support of the notion, Tuon's Dersuldam had taken all of her Suldam and Damani into the country for exercise 9 days ago, and they had not been seen since. Exercising Damani did not require 9 days, and just today, no, yesterday now by a good few hours, Suroth had learned that the captain of Tuon's bodyguard also had left the city 9 days ago with a sizable contingent of his men, and not returned. That was too much for coincidence, and very nearly proof. Near enough for hope, at least. Each of those previous disappearances, however, had been part of Tuon's campaign to win the approval of the Empress, might she live forever, and be named heir. Each time some competitor among her sisters had been forced or emboldened to acts that lowered her when Tuan reappeared. What need had she of such stratagems now, here? Rack her brains how she would, Suroth could not find a worthy target outside Shonshan. She had considered the possibility that she herself was the mark, but only briefly, and only because she could think of no one else. Tuan could have stripped her of her position in the return with three words. All she needed to do was remove the veil. Here, the daughter of the Nine Moons, in command of the return, spoke with the voice of the Empire. Bare suspicion that Suroth was Atha'an Shadar, what those this side of the Arath Ocean called a dark friend, might have been enough for Tuan to have handed her over to the Seekers for questioning. No, Tuan was aiming at someone else, or something else, if she did still live. But she had to. Suroth did not want to die. She fingered the blade. Who or what else did not matter, except as a clue to where Tuan might be, but that was very important, immensely so. Already, despite the announcement of an extended inspection trip, whispers floated among the blood that she was dead. The longer she remained missing, the more those whispers would grow, and with them the pressure for Suroth to return to Shandar and make that apology. She could only resist so long before she would be adjudged Saimosief so deeply that only her own servants and property would obey her. Her eyes would be ground into the dirt. Low blood as well as high, perhaps even commoners would refuse to speak to her. Soon after that she would find herself on a ship, whatever her wishes. Without doubt, Tuan would be displeased at being found, yet it seemed unlikely her displeasure would extend so far as Suroth being dishonored and forced to slit her wrists. Therefore Tuan must be found. Every seeker in Altara was searching for her, those Suroth knew of, at least. Tuan's own seekers were not among the known, yet they must be hunting twice as hard as any others, unless they had been taken into her confidence. But in 17 days, all that had been uncovered was that ridiculous story of Tuan extorting jewelry from goldsmiths, and that was known to every common soldier. Perhaps... The arched door to the anteroom began to open slowly, and Suroth snapped her right eye shut to protect her night vision against the light of the outer room. As soon as the gap was wide enough, a pale-haired woman in the diaphanous robes of a Dako veil slipped into the bedchamber and softly closed the door behind her, plunging the room into pitch blackness. Until Suroth opened her eye again and made out a shadowy form creeping toward her bed. And another shadow, huge, suddenly looming in a corner of the room as Al-Mandaragal rose noiselessly to his feet. The Lopar could cross the room and snap the fool woman's neck in a heartbeat, but Suroth still gripped the hilt of her dagger. It was wise to have a second line of defense even when the first seemed impregnable. A pace short of the bed, the Dako veil stopped. Her anxious breathing sounded loud in the silence.
"Working up your courage, Leandrin?" Suroth said harshly.
That honey-colored hair, worked in thin braids, had been enough to name her. With a squeak, the Dako veil dropped to her knees and bent to press her face to the carpet. She had learned that much, at least.
"I would not harm you, High Lady," she lied. "You know I would not."
Her voice was rushed, in a breathy panic. Learning when to speak and when not seemed as far beyond her as learning how to speak with proper respect.
"We are both bound to serve the Great Lord, High Lady. Have I not proven I can be useful? I removed Alwyn for you, yes? You said you wished her dead, High Lady, and I removed her."
Suroth grimaced and sat up in the dark, the sheet sliding down to her lap. It was so easy to forget Dako veil were there, even this Dako veil, and then you let slip things you should not have. Alwyn had not been dangerous, merely a nuisance, awkward in her place as Suroth's voice. She had achieved all she had ever wanted in reaching that, and the likelihood of her risking it by so much as the smallest betrayal had been tiny. True, had she broken her neck, falling down a flight of stairs, Suroth would have felt some small relief from an irritant, but poison that left the woman with bulging eyes and a blue face was another matter. Even with the search for Tuan, that had brought the Seeker's eyes to Suroth's household. She had been forced to insist on it for the murder of her voice. That there were listeners in her household, she accepted. Every household had its share of listeners. Seekers did more than listen, though, and they might uncover what must remain hidden. Masking her anger required surprising effort, and her tone was colder than she wanted.
I hope you did not wake me merely to plead again, Leandrin.
No, no!
The fool raised her head and actually looked straight at her.
An officer came from General Galgan, High Lady. He is waiting to take you to the general.
Suroth's head throbbed with irritation. The woman delayed delivering a message from Galgan and looked her in the eyes? In the dark, to be sure, yet an urge swept over her to strangle Leandrin with her bare hands. A second death hard on the heels of the first would intensify the Seeker's interest in her household if they learned of it. But Elbar could dispose of the body easily. He was clever in such tasks. Except, she enjoyed owning the former Aes Sedai who once had been so haughty with her. Making her a perfect Duck O'Vale in every way would be a great pleasure. It was time to have the woman collared, however. Already, irritating rumors buzzed of an uncollared Marath Damani among her servants. It would be a 12-day wonder when the Suldam discovered she was shielded in some way so she could not channel, yet that would help answer the question of why she had not been leashed before. Elbar would need to find some Atha'an Shadar among the Suldam, though. That was never an easy task. Relatively few Suldam returned to the Great Lord, oddly, and she no longer really trusted any Suldam. But perhaps Atha'an Shadar could be trusted more than the rest.
Light two lamps, then bring me a robe and slippers, she said, swinging her legs over the side of the bed.
Leandrin scrambled to the table that held the lidded sand bowl on its gilded tripod and hissed when she found it with a careless hand, but she quickly used the tongs to lift out a hot coal, puffed it to a glow, and lit two of the silvered lamps, adjusting the wicks so the flames held steady and did not smoke. Her tongue might suggest that she felt herself Suroth's equal rather than a possession, yet the strap had taught her to obey commands with alacrity. Turning with one of the lamps in her hand, she gave a start and a choked cry at the sight of Almandaragal looming in the corner, his dark, ridge-ringed eyes focused on her. You would think she had never seen him before. Yet he was a fearsome sight, 10 feet tall and near 2,000 pounds. His hairless skin like reddish-brown leather, flexing his six-toed forepaws so his claws extended and retracted. Be at ease, Suroth told the Lopar, a familiar command, but he stretched his mouth wide, showing sharp teeth, before settling back to the floor and resting his huge round head on his paws like a hound. He did not close his eyes again, either. Lopar were quite intelligent, and plainly he trusted Leandrin no more than she did. Despite fearful glances at Almandaragal, the Duck O'Vale was quick enough to fetch blue velvet slippers and a white silk robe intricately embroidered in green, red, and blue from the tall carved wardrobe, and she held the robe for Suroth to thrust her arms into the sleeves. But Suroth had to tie the long sash herself, and to thrust out a foot, before Leandrin remembered to kneel and fit the slippers on. Her eyes, but the woman was incompetent. By the dim light, Suroth examined herself in the gilded stand mirror against the wall. Her eyes were hollow and shadowed with weariness. The tail of her crest hung down her back in a loose braid for sleeping, and doubtless her scalp required a razor. Very well. Galgan's messenger would think her grief-stricken over Tuon, and that was true enough. Before learning the general's message, though, she had one small matter to take care of.
Run to Rosala and beg her to beat you soundly, Leandrin, she said.
The Duck O'Vale's tight little mouth dropped open and her eyes widened in shock.
But why? She whined. Me, I have done nothing.
Suroth busied her hands with knotting the sash tighter to keep from striking the woman. Her eyes would be lowered for a month if it was learned that she had struck a Duck O'Vale herself. She certainly owed no explanations to property, yet once Leandrin did become completely trained, she would miss these opportunities to grind the woman's face in how far she had fallen.
Because you delayed telling me of the general's messenger. Because you still call yourself I rather than Leandrin. Because you meet my eyes,
She could not help hissing that. Leandrin had huddled in on herself with every word, and now she directed her eyes to the floor as if that would mitigate her offense.
"Because you question my orders instead of obeying. And last but most importantly to you, because I wish you beaten. Now run and tell Rosala each of these reasons so she will beat you well."
"Leandrin hears and obeys, High Lady," the Dacovale whimpered, at last getting something right, and flung herself at the door so fast that she lost one of her white slippers. Too terrified to turn back for it, or perhaps even to notice, and well for her that she was, she clawed the door open and ran. Sending property for discipline should not bring a sense of satisfaction, but it did. Oh, yes, it did.
Suroth took a moment to control her breathing. To appear to be grieving was one thing, to appear to be agitated quite another. She was filled with annoyance at Leandrin, jolting memories of her nightmares, fears for Tuan's fate and even more so her own, but not until the face in the mirror displayed utter calm did she follow the Dacovale. The anteroom to her bedchamber was decorated in the garish Ebudari fashion, a cloud-painted blue ceiling, yellow walls, and green and yellow floor tiles, even replacing the furnishings with her own tall screens, all save two, painted by the finest artists with birds or flowers, did little to relieve the gaudiness. She growled faintly in her throat at sight of the outer door, apparently left open by Leandrin's flight. But she dismissed the Dacovale from her mind for the moment and concentrated on the man who stood there examining the screen that held the image of a quarry, a huge spotted cat from the Centaur. Lanky and graying in armor striped blue and yellow, he pivoted smoothly at the soft sound of her footsteps and went to one knee, though he was a commoner. The helmet beneath his arm bore three slender blue plumes, so the message must be important. Of course it must be important to disturb her at this hour. She would give him dispensation. This once.
"Banner General Mihail Najira, High Lady. Captain General Galgun's compliments, and he has received communications from Tarabon."
Suroth's eyebrows climbed in spite of herself. Tarabon? Tarabon was as secure as Shondar. Automatically her fingers twitched, but she had not yet found a replacement for Alwyn. She must speak to the man herself. Irritation over that hardened her voice, and she made no effort to soften it. Kneeling instead of prostrate.
"What communications? If I have been wakened for news of Aiel, I will not be pleased, Banner General."
Her tone failed to intimidate the man. He even raised his eyes almost to meet hers.
"Not Aiel, High Lady," he said calmly. "Captain General Galgun wishes to tell you himself so you can hear every detail correctly."
Suroth's breath caught for an instant. Whether Najira was just reluctant to tell her the contents of these communications or had been ordered not to, this sounded ill.
"Lead on," she commanded, then swept out of the room without waiting for him, ignoring as best she could the pair of Death Watch guards standing like statues in the hallway to either side of the door.
The honor of being guarded by those men in red and green armor made her skin crawl. Since Tuan's disappearance, she tried not to see them at all. The corridor, lined with gilded stand lamps whose flames flickered in errant drafts that stirred tapestries of ships and the sea, was empty except for a few liveried palace servants, scurrying on early tasks, who thought deep bows and curtsies sufficient. And they always looked right at her. Perhaps a word with Beslan? No, the new king was her equal now, in law at any rate, and she doubted that he would make his servants behave properly. She stared straight ahead as she walked. That way she did not have to see the servants' insults. Najira caught up to her quickly, his boots ringing on the two bright blue floor tiles, and fell in at her side. In truth, she needed no guide. She knew where Galgun must be. The room had begun as a chamber for dancing, a square 30 paces on a side, its ceiling painted with fanciful fish and birds frolicking in often confusing fashion among clouds and waves. Only the ceiling remained to recall the room's beginnings. Now mirrored stand lamps and shelves full of filed reports in leather folders lined the pale red walls. brown-coated clerks scurried along the aisles between the long map-strewn tables that covered the green-tiled dancing floor. A young officer, an under-lieutenant with no plume on her red and yellow helmet, raced past Suroth without so much as a move to prostrate herself. Clerks merely squeezed themselves out of her path. Galgun gave his people too much leeway. He claimed that what he called excessive ceremony at the wrong time hindered efficiency. She called it effrontery. Lunal Galgun, a tall man in a red robe richly worked with bright-feathered birds, the hair of his crest snow-white and its tail plaited in a tight but untidy queue that hung to his shoulders, stood at a table near the center of the room with a knot of other high-ranking officers, some in breastplates, others in robes and nearly as disheveled as she. It seemed she was not the first to whom he had sent a messenger. She struggled to keep anger from her face. Galgun had come with Tuon and the Return, and thus she knew little of him beyond that his ancestors had been among the first to throw their support to Luthair Payandrag, and that he owned a high reputation as a soldier and a general. Well, reputation and truth were sometimes the same. She disliked him entirely for himself. He turned at her approach and formally laid his hands on her shoulders, kissing her on either cheek, so she was forced to return the greeting while trying not to wrinkle her nose at the strong, musky scent he favored. Galgun's face was as smooth as his creases would allow, but she thought she detected a hint of worry in his blue eyes. A number of the men and women behind him, mainly low blood and commoners, wore open frowns. The large map of Terrabon spread out on the table in front of her and held flat by four lamps gave reason enough for worry. Markers covered it, red wedges for Seanchan forces on the move, and red stars for forces holding in place, each supporting a small paper banner inked with their numbers and composition. Scattered across the map, across the entire map, lay black disks marking engagements, and even more white disks for enemy forces, many of those without the banners. How could there be any enemies in Tarabon? It was as secure as...
What happened? She demanded.
Rakan began arriving with reports from Lieutenant General Turan about 3 hours ago, Galgun began in conversational tones, pointedly not making a report himself. He studied the map as he talked, never glancing in her direction. They aren't complete. Each new one adds to the lists, and I expect that won't change for a while, but what I've seen runs this way. Since dawn yesterday, 7 major supply camps overrun and burned, along with more than 24 smaller camps. 20 supply trains attacked, the wagons and their contents put to the torch. 17 small outposts have been wiped out, 11 patrols have failed to report in, and there have been an additional 15 skirmishes. Also a few attacks against our settlers. Only a handful of fatalities, mostly men who tried to defend their belongings, but a good many wagons and stores burned along with some half-built houses and the same message delivered everywhere. Leave Tarabon. All this was done by bands of between 200 and perhaps 500 men. Estimates are a minimum of 10,000 and perhaps twice that, nearly all Taraboners. Oh yes, he finished casually. And most of them are wearing armor painted with stripes.
She wanted to grind her teeth. Galgun commanded the soldiers of the Return, yet she commanded the Kuren, the Forerunners, and as such she possessed the higher rank in spite of his crest and red lacquered fingernails. She suspected the only reason he did not claim that the Forerunners had been absorbed into the Return by its very arrival was that supplanting her meant assuming responsibility for Tuon's safety. And for that apology, should it become necessary. Dislike was too mild a word. She loathed Galgun. A mutiny, she said, proud of the coolness of her voice. Inside, she had begun to burn. Galgun's white queue swung slowly as he shook his head.
No. All reports say our Taraboners have fought well and we've had a few successes, taken a few prisoners. Not one of them can be found on the rosters of loyal Taraboners. Several have been identified as Dragonsworn, believed to be up in Arad-Daman. And the name Rodal Iteralda has been mentioned a number of times as the brain behind it all. And the leader, a Damani. He's supposed to be one of the best generals this side of the ocean. And if he planned and carried out all this, he swept a hand over the map, then I believe it. The fool sounded admiring. Not a mutiny, a raid on a grand scale, but he won't get out with nearly as many men as he brought in. Dragons sworn. The word was like a fist clutching Suroth's throat.
Are there Ashaman?
Those fellows who can channel? Galgun grimaced and made a sign against evil, apparently unconscious of doing so.
There was no mention of them, he said dryly, and I rather think there would have been.
Red-hot anger needed to erupt at Galgun, but screaming at another of the high blood would lower her eyes, and, as bad, gain nothing. Still, it had to be directed somewhere. It had to come out. She was proud of what she had done in Tarabon, and now the country appeared to be halfway back to the chaos she found when she first landed there. And one man was to blame.
This Iteralda, her tone was ice. I want his head.
Never fear, Galgun murmured, folding his hands behind his back and bending to examine some of the small banners.
It won't be long before Turan chases him back to Arad-Daman with his tail between his legs, and with luck he'll be with one of the bands we snap up.
Luck, she snapped.
I don't trust your luck.
Her anger was open now, and she did not consider trying to suppress it again. Her eyes scanned the map as though she could find Iteralda that way.
If Turan is hunting 100 bands, as you suggest, he'll need more scouts to run them down, and I want them run down. Every last one of them, especially Iteralda. General Yulun, I want 9 in every 10 Rakan and Altar and Amadisha move to Tarabon. If Turan can't find them with all that, then he can see if his own head will appease me.
Yulun, a dark little man in a blue robe embroidered with black crested eagles, must have dressed in too great a hurry to apply the gum that normally held his wig in place, because he was constantly touching the thing to make sure it was straight. He was captain of the air for the Forerunners, but the returns captain of the air was only a banner general, a more senior man having died on the voyage. Yulun would have no trouble with him.
A wise move, High Lady, he said, frowning at the map.
But may I suggest leaving the Rakan in Amadisia and those assigned to Banner General Kirgan? Rakan are the best way we have to locate Aiel, and in 2 days we still haven't found those white cloaks. That will still give General Turan...
The Aiel are less of a problem every day, she told him firmly, and a few deserters are nothing.
He inclined his head in assent, one hand keeping his wig in place. He was only low blood, after all.
I hardly call 7,000 men a few deserters, Galgun murmured dryly. It shall be as I command, she snapped.
Curse those so-called children of the light. She still had not decided whether to make Asunawa and the few thousand who had remained Dako Vale. They had remained, yet how long before they offered betrayal too? And Asunawa seemed to hate Damani of all things. The man was unbalanced. Galgun shrugged, utterly unperturbed. A red lacquered fingernail traced lines on the map as though he were planning movements of soldiers.
So long as you don't want the Torakan, too, I raise no objections. That plan must go forward. Altara is falling into our hands with barely a struggle. I'm not ready to move on Ilion yet, and we need to pacify Tarabon again quickly. The people will turn against us if we can't give them safety.
Suroth began to regret letting her anger show.
He would raise no objections? He was not ready for Ilion yet?
He was all but saying that he did not have to follow her orders, only not openly, not so he had to take her responsibility along with her authority.
I expect this message to be sent to Turan, General Galgun.
Her voice was steady, kept so by will alone.
He is to send me Rodal Iteralda's head if he has to hound the man across Arad-Daman and into the Blight. And if he fails to send me that head, I will take his.
Galgun's mouth tightened briefly, and he frowned down at the map.
"Turon sometimes needs a fire lit under him," he muttered. "And Arad-Daman has always been next for him." "Very well. Your message will be sent, Suroth."
She could stay no longer in the same room with him. Without a word, she left. Had she spoken, she would have screamed. She stalked all the way back to her rooms without bothering to mask her fury. The Death Watch guards took no notice, of course. They might as well have been carved of stone, which made her slam the anteroom door behind her with a crash. Perhaps they noticed that. Padding toward her bed, she kicked off her slippers, let the robe and sash fall to the floor. She must find Tuon. She had to. If only she could puzzle out Tuon's target, puzzle out where she was. If only... Suddenly the walls of her bedchamber, the ceiling, even the floor, began to glow with the silvery light. Those surfaces seemed to have become light. Gaping in shock, she turned slowly, staring at the box of light that surrounded her, and found herself looking at a woman made of roiling flames, clothed in roiling flames. Alman Daragal was on his feet, awaiting his owner's command to attack.
"I am Semirag,"
the woman of fire said in a voice like a tolling funeral gong.
"Belly, Alman Daragal!"
That command, taught as a child because it amused her to have the Lopar prostrate himself before her, ended with a grunt because she obeyed it herself even as she gave it. Kissing the red and green patterned carpet, she said,
"I live to serve and obey, great mistress."
There was no doubt in her mind that this woman was who she said. Who would dare claim that name falsely, or could appear as living fire?
"I think you would also like to rule."
The tolling gong sounded faintly amused, but then it hardened.
"Look at me. I dislike the way you, Shanshan, avoid meeting my eyes. It makes me believe you are hiding something. You don't want to try hiding anything from me, Suroth."
"Of course not, great mistress," Suroth said, pushing herself up to sit on her heels. "Never, great mistress."
She raised her gaze as far as the other woman's mouth, but she could not make herself raise it higher. Surely that would be enough.
"Better," Semirag murmured. "Now, how would you like to rule in these lands? A handful of deaths, Galgun and a few others, and you could manage to name yourself Empress with my help. It's hardly important, but circumstances provide the opportunity, and you would certainly be more amenable than the current Empress has been so far."
Suroth's stomach clenched. She feared she might vomit.
"Great mistress," she said dully. "The penalty for that is to be taken before the true Empress, may she live forever, and have your entire skin removed, great care being taken to keep you alive. After that..."
"Inventive, if primitive," Semirag broke in wryly. "But of no account. The Empress Radhanan is dead. Remarkable how much blood there is in a human body. Enough to cover the whole Crystal Throne. Take the offer, Suroth. I will not make it again. You will make certain matters slightly more convenient, but not enough for me to put myself out a second time."
Suroth had to make herself breathe.
"Then Tuon is the Empress. May she live."
Tuon would take a new name, rarely to be spoken outside the Imperial family. The Empress was the Empress. Might she live forever. Wrapping her arms around herself, Suroth began to sob, shaking beyond her ability to stop. Alman Daragal lifted his head and whined at her interrogatively. Semirag laughed, the music of deep gongs.
"Grief for Radhanan, Suroth? Or is your dislike of Tuon becoming Empress so deep?"
Haltingly, in spurts of three or four words broken by unmanageable weeping, Suroth explained. As the proclaimed heir, Tuon had become Empress the moment her mother died. except if her mother had been assassinated, then it must have been arranged by one of her sisters, which meant that Tuan herself was surely dead. And none of that made the slightest difference. The forms would be carried out. She would have to return to Shandar and apologize for Tuan's death. For the death of an empress, now, to the very woman who had arranged it. Who would, of course, not take the throne until Tuan's death was announced. She could not bring herself to admit that she would kill herself first. It was too shaming to say aloud. Words died as howling sobs racked her. She did not want to die. She had been promised she would live forever. This time Semirag's laughter was so shocking that it shut off Suroth's tears. That head of fire was thrown back, emitting great peals of mirth. At last she regained control, wiping away tears of flame with fiery fingers.
I see I didn't make myself clear. Radhanan is dead, and her daughters, and her sons, and half the imperial court as well. There is no imperial family except for Tuan. There is no empire. Shandar is in the hands of rioters and looters, and so are a dozen other cities. At least 50 nobles are contending for the throne with armies in the field. There is war from the Aldale Mountains to Salaking, which is why you will be perfectly safe in disposing of Tuan and proclaiming yourself empress. I've even arranged for a ship which should arrive soon to bring word of the disaster.
She laughed again and said something strange.
Let the Lord of Chaos rule.
Suroth gaped at the other woman in spite of herself. The Empire? Destroyed? Semirag had killed the... Assassination was not unknown among the Blood, high or low, nor within the Imperial family. Yet for anyone else to reach inside the Imperial family in that way was horrifying, unthinkable. Even one of the Dakoncian, the chosen ones. But to become Empress herself, even here. She felt dizzy, with a hysterical desire to laugh. She could complete the cycle, conquering these lands, and then send armies to reclaim Shanshan. With an effort, she managed to regain possession of herself.
Great mistress, if Tuan really is alive, then killing her will be difficult.
She had to force those words out. To kill the Empress, even thinking it was difficult. To become Empress. Her head felt as if it might float off her shoulders.
She will have her Suldam and Domani with her and some of her Death Watch guards.
Difficult? Killing her would be impossible in those circumstances, unless Semirag could be induced to do it herself. 6 Domani might well be dangerous even to her. Besides, there was a saying among commoners, the mighty tell the lesser to dig in the mud and keep their own hands clean. She had heard it by chance and punished the man who spoke it, but it was true.
Think, Suroth, the gongs rang, strong, imperative. Captain Musenji and the others would have gone the same night Tuan and her maid left if they had had any inkling of what she was about. They are looking for her. You must put every effort into finding her first, but if that fails, her Death Watch guards will be less protection than they seem. Every soldier in your army has heard that at least some of the guards are involved with an impostor. The general feeling seems to be that the impostor and anyone connected to her should be torn apart bodily, and the pieces buried in a dung heap, quietly.
Lips of fire curled in a small, amused smile,
to avoid the shame to the Empire.
It might be possible. A party of Death Watch guards would be easy to locate. She would need to find out exactly how many Musenji had taken with him and send Elbar with 50 for every one. No. 100, to account for the Domani. And then...
Great mistress, you understand I am reluctant to proclaim anything until I am certain Tuan is dead?
Of course, Semirag said.
The gongs were amused once more.
But remember, if Tuan manages to return safely, it will matter little to me, so don't dally.
I will not, great mistress. I intend to become empress, and for that I must kill the empress.
This time, saying it was not very hard at all. In Pervara's estimation, Tsutama Rath's rooms were flamboyant beyond the point of extravagance, and her own beginnings as a butcher's daughter played no part in her opinion. The sitting room simply put her on edge. Beneath a cornice carved with swallows in flight and gilded, the walls held two large silk tapestries, one displaying bright red blood roses, the other a kalma bush covered in scarlet blossoms larger than her two hands together. The tables and chairs were delicate pieces, if you ignored sufficient carving and gilding for any throne. The stand lamps were heavily gilded, too, and the mantel worked with running horses above the red-streaked marble fireplace. Several of the tables held red seafolk porcelain, the rarest, four vases and six bowls, a small fortune in themselves, as well as any number of jade or ivory carvings, none small, and one figure of a dancing woman, a hand tall, that appeared to be carved from a ruby. A gratuitous display of wealth, and she knew for a fact that aside from the gilded barrel clock on the mantel, there was another in Tsutama's bedroom and even one in her dressing room. Three clocks! That went far beyond flamboyant, never mind gilding or rubies. And yet the room suited the woman seated across from her and Javindra. Flamboyant was exactly the word for her appearance. Tsutama was a strikingly beautiful woman, her hair caught in a fine golden net, with fire drops thick at her throat and ears, and dressed as always in crimson silk that molded her full bosom, today with golden scrollwork embroidery to increase the emphasis. You might almost think she wanted to attract men if you did not know her. Tsutama had made her dislike of men well known long before being sent into exile. She would have given mercy to a rabid dog before a man. Back then she had been hammer hard, yet many had thought her a broken reed when she returned to the tower. For a while they had. Then everyone who spent any time near her realized that those shifting eyes were far from nervous. Exile had changed her, only not toward softness. Those eyes belonged on a hunting cat, searching for enemies or prey. The rest of Tsutama's face was not so much serene as it was still an unreadable mask. Unless you pushed her to open anger, at least. Even then her voice would remain as calm as smooth ice, though, an unnerving combination. "I heard disturbing rumors this morning about the battle at Dumai's Wells," she said abruptly. "Bloody disturbing." She had the habits now of long silences, no small talk, and sudden unexpected statements. Exile had coarsened her language, too. The isolated farm she had been confined to must have been vivid. "Including that three of the dead sisters were from our Aja, mother's milk in a cup." All delivered in the most even tones, but her eyes stabbed at them accusingly. Pervara took that gaze in stride. Any direct look from Tsutama seemed accusing, and on edge or not, Pervara knew better than to let the highest see it. The woman swooped on weakness like a falcon. "I can't see why Katerina would disobey your orders to keep her knowledge to herself. And you cannot believe Tarna is likely to put discredit on Elida. Not publicly, at any rate." Tarna guarded her feelings on Elida as carefully as a cat guarded a mouse hole. "But sisters do get reports from their eyes and ears. We can't stop them learning what happened. I'm surprised it's taken this long." "That's so," Javindra added, smoothing her skirts. The angular woman wore no jewelry aside from the great serpent ring, and her dress was unadorned, and a red deep enough to appear near black. "Sooner or later the facts will all come out if we work till our fingers bleed." Her mouth was so tight she seemed to be biting something, yet she sounded almost satisfied. Odd, that. She was Elida's lapdog. Tsutama's stare focused on her, and after a moment a flush grew on Javindra's cheeks. Perhaps as an excuse to break eye contact, she took a long drink of her tea. From a cup of beaten gold worked with leopards and deer, of course, Tsutama being as she now was. The highest continued to stare silently, but whether at Javindra or something beyond her, Pervara could no longer say. When Katerina brought word that Galina was among the dead at Dumai's Wells, Tsutama had been raised to replace her by near acclamation. She had possessed a very good reputation as a sitter, at least before her involvement in the disgusting events that led to her downfall, and many in the Red believed the times called for as hard a heist as could be found. Galena's death had lifted a great weight from Pavara's shoulders. The highest, a dark friend. Oh, that had been agony. Yet she was uncertain about Tsutama. There was something wild about her now, something unpredictable. Was she entirely sane? But then the same question could be asked regarding the whole White Tower. How many of the sisters were entirely sane now? As if sensing her thoughts, Tsutama shifted that unblinking gaze to her. It did not make Pavara color or start, as it did so many besides Javindra, but she did find herself wishing Duhara were there, just to give the highest a third sitter to stare at, just to share them out. She wished she knew where the woman had gone and why, with a rebel army camped outside Tarvalen. Over a week ago, Duhara had simply taken ship without a word to anyone, so far as Pavara was aware, and no one seemed to know whether she had gone north or south. These days, Pavara was suspicious of everyone and nearly everything. "Did you call us here because of something in that letter, Highest?" she said at last. She met that unsettling stare levelly, yet she was beginning to want a long pull from her own ornate cup, and she wished it held wine rather than tea. Deliberately, she rested the cup on the narrow arm of her chair. The other woman's gaze made her feel as though spiders were crawling on her skin. After a very long moment, Tsutama's eyes dropped to the folded letter in her lap. Only her hand held it from rolling up into a little cylinder. It was on the very thin paper used for messages sent by pigeon, and the small inked letters clearly visible through the page appeared to cover it densely. "This is from Sashal Anderley," she said, bringing a wince of pity from Pavara and a grunt that might have been anything from Javindra. "Poor Sashal." Tsutama continued without any outward sign of sympathy, though. "The bloody woman believes Galena escaped because it is addressed to her. Much of what she writes merely confirms what we already know from other sources, including Tovain. But without naming them, she bloody well says that she is in charge of most of the sisters in the city of Kyrian." "How can Sashal be in charge of any sisters?" Javindra shook her head, her expression denying the possibility. "Could she have gone insane?" Pavara held her silence. Tsutama gave answers when she wished, rarely when you asked. Tovain's earlier letter, also addressed to Galena, had not mentioned Sashal at all, or the other two, but of course she would have found the entire subject beyond distasteful. Even thinking of it was like eating rotten plums. Most of her words had been devoted to laying the whole blame for events at Elida's feet, however indirectly. Tsutama's eyes flickered toward Javindra like dagger thrusts, but she went on without pausing. "Sashal recounts Tovain's bloody visit to Kyrian with the other sisters and the flaming Ashaman, though she clearly doesn't know about the bloody bonding. She found it all very strange, sisters mingling with Ashaman on tense yet often friendly terms. Blood and bloody ashes. That is how she puts it, burn me." Tsutama's tone, suitable for discussing the price of lace, in strong contrast to the intensity of her eyes and her language, gave no hint of what she felt on the subject. "Sashal says that when they left, they took flaming warders belonging to sisters she believes are with the boy, so it seems bloody certain they were looking for him and likely have found him by now. She has no idea why. But she confirms what Tovain claimed concerning Loghain. Apparently the bloody man is no longer gentled." "Impossible," Javindra muttered into her teacup, but softly. Tsutama disliked having her statements challenged. Pavara kept her opinions to herself and sipped from her own cup. So far there seemed nothing in the letter worthy of discussion except how Sashal could be in charge of anything, and she would rather think of anything other than Sashal's fate. The tea tasted of blueberries. How had Tsutama obtained blueberries this early in the spring? Perhaps they had been dried. "I will read the rest to you," Tsutama said, unfolding the page and scanning almost to the bottom before beginning. Apparently, Sashal had been very detailed. What was the highest not sharing? so many suspicions.
I have been so long without communicating because I could not work out how to say what I must, but now I see that simply telling the facts is the only way. Along with a number of other sisters, who I will leave to decide for themselves whether to reveal what I am about to, I have sworn an oath of fealty to the Dragon Reborn, which is to last until Tarman Gaiden has been fought. Javindra gasped loudly, her eyes popping, but Pevara merely whispered, "Taviren." It must be that. Taviren had always been her explanation for most of the disturbing rumors out of Kyrian. Tsutama read on right over them. "What I do for the good of the Red Aja and the good of the Tower. Should you disagree, I will surrender myself for your discipline, after Tarman Gaiden. As you may have heard, Ergain Fatamed, Ronaila Vivanios, and I were all stilled when the Dragon Reborn escaped at Dumai's Wells. We have been healed, however, by a man named Damer Flynn, one of the Ashaman, and we all seem to be restored fully. Unlikely as this seems, I swear beneath the light and by my hope of salvation and rebirth that it is true. I look forward to my eventual return to the Tower, where I will retake the three oaths to reaffirm my dedication to my Aja and to the Tower." Folding the letter again, she gave her head a small shake. "There's more, but it's all more bloody pleading that what she's doing is for the Aja and the Tower." A glitter in her eyes suggested that Sashal might come to regret surviving the last battle. "If Sashal truly has been healed," Pevara began, and could not go on. She wet her lips with tea, then raised the cup again and took a mouthful. The possibility seemed too wonderful to hope for, a snowflake that might melt at a touch. "This is impossible," Javindra growled, though not very strongly. Even so, she directed the comment to Pevara, lest the highest think it meant for her. A deep scowl made her face harsher. "Gentling cannot be healed. Stilling cannot be healed. Sheep will fly first. Sashal must be delusional."
"Tovain might be mistaken," Tsutama said in a very strong voice. "Though if she is, I can't see why these flaming Ashaman would let Loghain be one of them, much less command. But I hardly think Sashal could be bloody mistaken about herself. And she doesn't write like a woman having flaming delusions. Sometimes what is bloody impossible is only bloody impossible until the first woman does it. So, Stilling has been healed. By a man. Those flaming Shanchen locusts are chaining every woman they find who can channel, apparently including a number of sisters. 12 days passed. Well, you know what happened as bloody well as I. The world has become a more dangerous place than at any time since the Trolloc Wars, perhaps since the Breaking itself. Therefore, I've decided we will move forward with your scheme for these flaming Ashaman, Pevara. Distasteful and hazardous, yet burn me, there is no bloody choice. You and Javindra will arrange it together."
Pevara winced. Not for the Shanshan. They were human, whatever strange Tarangreal they possessed, and they would be defeated eventually. Mention of what the Forsaken had done 12 days ago brought a grimace, though, despite her efforts at keeping a smooth face. So much of the power wielded in one place could have been no one else. To the extent she could, she avoided thinking about that or what they might have been trying to accomplish, or worse, what they might have accomplished. A second wince came at hearing the proposal to bond Ashaman named as hers, but that had been inevitable from the moment she presented Tarna's suggestion to Tsutama, while holding her breath against the eruption she was sure would come. She had even used the argument of increasing the size of linked circles by including men against that monstrous display of the power. Surprisingly, there had been no eruption and small reaction of any kind. Tsutama merely said she would think on it, and insisted on having the relevant papers about men and circles delivered to her from the library. The third wince, the largest, was for having to work with Javindra, for being saddled with the job at all. She had more than enough on her plate at the moment, besides which working with Javindra was always painful. The woman argued against anything put forward by anyone save herself. Nearly anything. Javindra had been vehemently against bonding Ashaman, horrified at the notion of Red Sisters bonding anyone almost as much as at bonding men who could channel. Yet now that the highest had commanded it, she was stymied.
Still, she found a way to argue against.
Elida will never allow it, she muttered.
Tsutama's glittering eyes caught her gaze and held it. The bony woman swallowed audibly.
Elida will not know until it is too late, Javindra. I hide her secrets. The disaster against the Black Tower, Dumai's Wells, as best I can because she was raised from the Red. But she is the Amarlin seat of all Ajahs and none.
That means she is no longer Red, and this is Aja business, not hers. A dangerous tone entered her voice, and she had not cursed once. That meant she was on the edge of open fury.
Do you disagree with me on this? Do you intend to inform Elida despite my express wishes?
No, Highest, Javindra replied quickly, then buried her face in her cup. Strangely, she seemed to be hiding a smile. Pavara contented herself with shaking her head. If it had to be done, and she was certain it must, then clearly Elida had to be kept in the dark. What did Javindra have to smile about? Too many suspicions.
I'm very glad that you both agree with me, Tsutama said dryly, leaning back in her chair. Now leave me. They paused only to set down their cups and curtsy.
In the Red, when the Highest spoke, everyone obeyed, including sitters. The sole exception by Aja law was voting in the hall, though some women who held the title had managed to ensure that any vote near to their hearts went as they wished. Pavara was certain Tsutama intended to be one such. The struggle was going to be distinctly unpleasant. She only hoped she could give as good as she got. In the corridor outside, Javindra muttered something about correspondence and rushed off down the white floor tiles marked with the red flame of Tarvalin before Pavara could say a word. Not that she had intended to say anything, but surely as peaches were poisoned, the woman was going to drag her heels in this and leave the whole matter in her lap. Light, but this was the last thing she needed at the worst possible time. Pausing at her own rooms only long enough to gather her long-fringed shawl and check the hour, a quarter of an hour to noon, she was almost disappointed that her one clock agreed with Tsutama's. Clocks frequently did not. She left the Red Quarters and hurried deeper into the tower, down into the common areas below the quarters. The wide hallways were well lighted with mirrored stand lamps, but almost empty of people, which made them seem cavernous, and the frieze-banded white walls stark. The occasional rippling of a bright tapestry in a draft had an eerie feel, as though the silk or wool had taken on life. The few people she saw were serving men and women with the flame of Tarvalin on their chests, scurrying along about their chores and barely pausing long enough to offer hurried courtesies. They kept their eyes lowered. With the Ajahs separated into all but warring camps, fetid tension and antagonism filled the tower, and the mood had infected the servants. Frightened them, at least. She could not be sure, but she thought fewer than 200 sisters remained in the tower, most keeping to their Aja quarters except for necessity, so she really did not expect to see another sister strolling. When Adalorna Bastine glided up the short stairs from a crossing corridor almost right in front of her, she was so surprised she gave a start. Adalorna, who made slimness appear stately despite her lack of height, walked on without acknowledging Pavara in any way. The Saldaean woman wore her shawl, too. No sister was seen outside her Aja quarters without her shawl now, and was followed by her three warders. Short and tall, wide and lean, they wore their swords, and their eyes never ceased moving. Warders wearing swords and plainly guarding their Aes Sedai's back in the tower. That was all too common, yet Pavara could have wept at it. Only there were too many reasons for weeping to settle on one. Instead, she set about solving what she could. Tsutama could command Reds to bond Ashaman, command them not to go running to Elida, but it seemed best to begin with sisters who might be willing to entertain the notion without being ordered, especially with rumors spreading of three Red sisters dead at Ashaman hands. Tarna Fair had already entertained it, so a very private conversation with her was in order. She might know others of a like mind. The greatest difficulty would be approaching the Ashaman with the idea. They were very unlikely to agree just because they themselves had already bonded 51 sisters. Light of the world? 51? Broaching the subject would require a sister who possessed diplomacy and a way with words. And iron nerve. She was still mulling over names when she saw the woman she had come to meet, already at the appointed place, apparently studying a tall tapestry. Tiny and willowy and regal in her pale silver silk, with a slightly darker lace at her neck and wrists, Eukiria appeared thoroughly engrossed in the tapestry and quite at her ease. Pavara could only recall seeing her the slightest bit flustered on one occasion, and putting Tallinn to the question had been nerve-wracking for everyone there. Yukiri was alone, of course, though of late she had been heard to say she was thinking of taking a warder again. Doubtless that was equal parts the current times and their own present situation. Pavara could have done with a warder or two herself. "Is there any truth in this, or is it all the weaver's fancy?" she asked, joining the smaller woman. The tapestry showed a long-ago battle against Trollocs, or was purported to. Most such things were made long after the fact, and the weavers usually went by hearsay. This one was old enough to need the protection of a warding to keep it from falling apart. "I know as much about tapestries as a pig knows about blacksmithing, Pavara." For all her elegance, Yukiri seldom let long pass without revealing her country origins. The silvery-gray fringe of her shawl swung as she gathered it around her. "You're late, so let's be brief. I feel like a hen being watched by a fox. Maris broke this morning, and I gave her the oath of obedience myself, but as with the others, her one other is out of the tower. With the rebels, I think." She fell silent as a pair of serving women approached up the hallway, carrying a large wicker laundry basket with neatly folded bed linens bulging from the top. Pavara sighed. It had seemed so encouraging at the start. Terrifying and nearly overwhelming, too, yet they had appeared to be making a good beginning. Tallinn had only known the name of one other black sister actually in the tower at present, but once Atuan had been kidnapped, Pavara would have liked to think of it as an arrest, yet she could not, when they seemed to be violating half of tower law and a good many strong customs besides. Once Atuan was safely in hand, she had soon been induced to surrender the names of her heart. Karala Sangir, a Damani Grey, and Maris Thornhill, an Andoran Brown. Only Karala among them had a warder, though he had turned out to be a dark friend too. Luckily, soon after learning that his Aes Sedai had betrayed him, he had managed to take poison in the basement room where he had been confined while Karala was questioned. Strange to think of that as lucky, but the oath rod only worked on those who could channel, and they were too few to guard and tend prisoners. It had been such a bright beginning, however fraught, and now they were at an impasse unless one of the others returned to the tower, back to searching for discrepancies between what sisters claimed to have done and what it could be proven they actually had, something made harder by the inclination of most sisters to be oblique in nearly everything. Of course, Tallinn and the other three would pass along whatever they knew, whatever came into their hands. The oath of obedience took care of that. But any message very much more important than "take this and put it in that place" would be in a cipher known only to the woman who sent it and the woman it was directed to. Some were protected by a weave that made the ink vanish if the wrong hand broke the seal. That could be done with so little of the power it might go unnoticed unless you were looking for it, and there appeared to be no way to circumvent the ward. If they were not at an impasse, then their flow of success was reduced to a creeping trickle. And always there was the danger that the hunted would learn of them and become the hunters. Invisible hunters, for all practical purposes, just as they now seemed invisible prey. Still, they had four names plus four sisters in hand who would admit they were dark friends, though likely Maris would be as quick as the other three to claim she now rejected the shadow, repented of her sins, and embraced the light once more. Enough to convince anyone. Supposedly the Black Aja knew everything that passed in Elida's study, yet it might be worth the risk. Pavara refused to believe Tallinn's claim that Elida was a dark friend. After all, she had initiated the hunt. The Ammerlin seat could rouse the entire tower.
Perhaps a revelation that the Black Aja truly existed might do what the appearance of the rebels with an army had failed to, stop the Ajas from hissing at one another like strange cats and bind them back together. The tower's wounds called for desperate remedies. The serving women passed beyond earshot, and Pevara was about to bring up the suggestion when Yukiri spoke again.
Last night, Talin received an order to appear tonight before their Supreme Council.
Her mouth twisted around the words in distaste.
It seems that happens only if you're being honored or given a very, very important assignment, or if you're to be put to the question.
Her lips almost writhed. What they had learned about the Black Aja's means of putting someone to the question was as nauseating as it was incredible. Forcing a woman into a circle against her will? Guiding a circle to inflict pain? Pevara felt her stomach writhing.
Talin doesn't think she's to be honored or given an assignment, Yukiri went on, so she begged to be hidden away. Sayarin put her in a room in the lowest basement. Talin may be wrong, but I agree with Sayarin. Risking it would be letting a dog into the chicken yard and hoping for the best.
Pevara stared up at the tapestry stretching well above their heads. Armored men swung swords and axes, stabbed spears and halberds at huge man-like shapes with boar's snouts and wolf's snouts, with goat's horns and ram's horns. The weaver had seen Trollocs, or accurate drawings. Men fought alongside the Trollocs, too. Dark friends. Sometimes fighting the shadow required spilling blood and desperate remedies.
Let Talin go to this meeting, she said. We'll all go. They won't expect us. We can kill or capture them and decapitate the Black at a stroke. This Supreme Council must know the names of all of them. We can destroy the whole Black Aja.
Lifting an edge of the fringe on Pevara's shawl with a slim hand, Yukiri frowned at it ostentatiously.
Yes. Red. I thought it might have turned green when I wasn't looking. There will be 13 of them, you know. Even if some of this council are out of the tower, the rest will bring in sisters to make up the number.
I know, Pevara replied impatiently.
Talin had been a fount of information, most of it useless and much of it horrifying, almost more than they could take in.
We take everyone. We can order Zera and the others to fight alongside us, and even Talin and that lot. They'll do as they're told.
In the beginning, she had been uneasy about that oath of obedience, but over time you could become accustomed to anything.
So, 19 of us against 13 of them, Yukiri mused, sounding much too patient. Even the way she adjusted her shawl radiated patience. Plus whoever they have watching to make sure their meeting isn't disturbed. Thieves are always the most careful of their purses.
That had the irritating sound of an old saying. Best to call the numbers even at best, and probably favoring them.
How many of us die in return for killing or capturing how many of them? More importantly, how many of them escape? Remember, they meet hooded. If just one escapes, then we won't know who she is, but she'll know us. And soon enough, the whole Black Aja will know, too. It sounds to me less like chopping off a chicken's head than like trying to wrestle a leopard in the dark.
Pevara opened her mouth, then closed it without speaking. Yukiri was right. She should have tallied the numbers and reached the same conclusion herself. But she wanted to strike out at something, at anything, and small wonder. The head of her Aja might be insane. She was tasked with arranging for Reds, who by ancient custom bonded no one, to bond not just any men, but Ashaman. And the hunt for dark friends in the tower had reached a stone wall. Strike out? She wanted to bite holes through bricks. She thought their meeting was at an end. She had come only to learn how matters progressed with Maris, and a bitter harvest that had turned out. But Yukiri touched her arm.
Walk with me a while. We've been here too long, and I want to ask you something.
Nowadays, sitters of different Ajas standing together too long made rumors of plots sprout like mushrooms after rain.
For some reason, talking while walking seemed to cause many fewer. It made no sense, but there it was. Yukiri took her time getting to her question. The floor tiles turned from green and blue to yellow and brown as they walked along one of the main corridors that spiraled gently through the tower, down 5 floors without seeing anyone else before she spoke. "Has the Red heard from anyone who went with Tovain?" Pavara almost tripped over her own slippers. She should have expected it, though. Tovain would not have been the only one to write from Kyrian. "From Tovain herself," she said, and told almost everything that had been in Tovain's letter. Under the circumstances, there was nothing else she could do. She did hold back the accusations against Elida, and also how long ago the letter had arrived. The one was still Aja business, she hoped, while the other might require awkward explanations. "We heard from Akura Vayet." Yukiri walked a few paces in silence, then muttered, "Blood and bloody ashes." Pavara's eyebrows rose in shock. Yukiri was often earthy, but never vulgar before this. She noted that the other woman had not said when Akura's letter arrived either. Had the Grey received other letters from Kyrian, from sisters who had sworn to the Dragon Reborn? She could not ask. They trusted one another with their lives in this hunt, and still Aja business was Aja business. "What do you intend doing with the information?" "We will keep silent for the good of the tower. Only the sitters and the head of our Aja know. Evanaline is for pulling Elida down because of this, but that can't be allowed now. With the tower to mend and the Shan Chan and Ashaman to be dealt with, perhaps never." She did not sound happy over that. Pavara stifled her irritation. She could not like Elida, yet you did not have to like the Ammerlin seat. Any number of very unlikable women had worn the stole and done well for the tower. But could sending 51 sisters into captivity be called doing well? Could Dumai's Wells, with 4 sisters dead and more than 20 delivered into another sort of captivity, to a Taviran? No matter. Elida was Red, had been Red, and far too long had passed since a Red gained the stole and staff. All the rash actions and ill-considered decisions seemed things of the past since the rebels appeared, and saving the tower from the Black Aja would redeem her failures. That was not how she put it, of course. She began the hunt, Yukiri. She deserves to finish it. Light, everything we've uncovered so far has come by chance, and we are at a full stop. We need the authority of the Ammerlin seat behind us if we're to get any further. "I don't know," the other woman said, wavering. "All 4 of them say the Black knows everything that happened in Elida's study." She bit at her lip and shrugged uncomfortably. "Perhaps if we can meet her alone, away from her study." "There you are. I've been looking everywhere." Pavara turned calmly at the sudden voice behind them, but Yukiri gave a start and muttered something pungent almost under her breath. If she kept this up, she would be as bad as Doasine or Tsutama. Cien hurried down to them with the fringes of her shawl swinging and her thick black eyebrows rising in surprise at Yukiri's glare. How like a white! Logical in everything and often blind to the world around them. Half the time, Cien seemed unaware they were in any danger at all. "You were looking for us?" Yukiri almost growled, planting her fists on her hips. Despite her diminutive size, she gave a good impression of fierce looming. Doubtless part of that was for being startled, but she still believed Cien should be guarded closely for her own protection, no matter what Saren had decided, and here the woman was, out and about, alone. "For you, for Saren, for anyone," Cien replied calmly. Her earlier fears that the Black Aja might know what work Elida had assigned her were quite gone. Her blue eyes held warmth, yet otherwise she was back to being the prototypical white, a woman of icy serenity. "I have urgent news," she said, as though it were anything but. "The lesser is this. This morning I saw a letter from Ayako Norsoni that arrived several days ago from Kyrian. She and Tovain and all the others have been captured by the Ashaman, and..." Tilting her head to one side, she studied them in turn. You aren't surprised in the slightest. Of course, you've seen letters, too. Well, there's nothing to be done about it now, anyway.
Pavara exchanged looks with Yukiri, then said,
This is the less urgent, Cien?
The white sitter's composure faded into worry, tightening her mouth and creasing the corners of her eyes. Her hands tightened into fists, gripping her shawl.
For us, it is. I've just come from answering a summons to Elida. She wanted to know how I was getting on.
Cien took a deep breath.
With discovering proof that Alviarin entered a treasonous correspondence with the Dragon Reborn. Really, she was so circumspect in the beginning, so indirect, it's no wonder I misunderstood what she wanted.
I think that fox is walking on my grave, Yukiri murmured.
Pavara nodded. The notion of approaching Elida had vanished like summer dew. Their one assurance that Elida was not herself Black Aja had been that she instigated the hunt for them. But since she had done no such thing, at least the Black Aja remained in ignorance of them. At least they had that, still. But for how much longer?
On mine, too, she said softly.
Alviarin glided along the corridors of the lower tower with an outward air of serenity that she held on to hard. Night seemed to cling to the walls despite the mirrored stand lamps, the ghosts of shadows dancing where none should be. Imagination, surely, yet they danced on the edges of vision. The hallways were very nearly empty, though the second sitting of supper had just ended. Most sisters preferred to have food brought up to their rooms these days, but the hardier and more defiant ventured to the dining halls from time to time, and a handful still took many of their meals below. She would not risk sisters seeing her appear flustered or hurried. She refused to let them believe she was scuttling about furtively. In truth, she disliked anyone looking at her at all. Outwardly calm, she seethed inside. Abruptly, she realized that she was fingering the spot on her forehead where Shaidar Haran had touched her, where the great lord himself had marked her as his. Hysteria bubbled almost to the surface with that thought, but she maintained a smooth face by sheer will and gathered her white silk skirts slightly. That should keep her hands occupied. The great lord had marked her. Best not to think on that. But how to avoid it? The great lord! On the outside she displayed absolute composure, but within was a swirling tangle of mortification and hatred, and very near to gibbering terror. The external calm was what mattered, though, and there was a seed of hope. That mattered, too. An odd thing to think of as hopeful, yet she would hang on to anything that might keep her alive. Stopping in front of a tapestry that showed a woman wearing an elaborate crown kneeling to some long-ago Amerlin, she pretended to examine it while glancing quickly to left and right. Aside from her, the corridor remained as barren of life as an abandoned tomb. Her hand darted behind the edge of the tapestry, and in an instant she was walking on again, clutching a folded message. A miracle that it had reached her so quickly. The paper seemed to burn her palm, but she could not read it here. At a measured pace, she climbed reluctantly to the White Aja quarters, calm and unfazed by anything, on the outside. The Great Lord had marked her. Other sisters were going to look at her. The White was the smallest of the Ajas, and barely more than 20 of its sisters were in the tower at present, yet it seemed that nearly all of them were out in the main hallway. The walk along the plain white floor tiles seemed like running a gauntlet. Cien and Farana were heading out despite the hour, shawls draped along their arms, and Cien gave her a small smile of commiseration, which made her want to kill the sitter, always thrusting her sharp nose in where it was unwanted. Farana held no sympathy. She scowled with more open fury than any sister should have allowed herself to show. All Alviarin could do was try to ignore the copper-skinned woman without being obvious. Short and stout, with her usually mild round face and an ink smudge on her nose, Farana was no one's image of a Damani, but the first reasoner possessed a fierce Damani temper. She was quite capable of handing down a penance for any slight, especially to a sister who had disgraced both herself and the White.
The Aja felt keenly the shame of her having been stripped of the Keeper's stole. Most felt anger at the loss of influence as well. There were far too many glares, some from sisters who stood far enough below her that they should leap to obey if she gave a command. Others deliberately turned their backs. She made her way through those frowns and snubs at a steady pace, unhurried, yet she felt her cheeks beginning to heat. She tried to immerse herself in the soothing nature of the white quarters. The plain white walls, lined with silvered stand mirrors, held only a few simple tapestries, images of snow-capped mountains, shady forests, stands of bamboo with sunlight slanting through them. Ever since attaining the shawl, she had used those images to help her find serenity in times of stress. The Great Lord had marked her. She clutched her skirts in fists to hold her hands at her sides. The message seemed to burn her hand, a steady, measured pace. Two of the sisters she passed ignored her simply because they did not see her. Estrella and Tassan were discussing food spoilage, arguing, rather. Faces smooth, but eyes heated and voices on the brink of heat. They were arithmetists of all things, as if logic could be reduced to numbers, and they seemed to be disagreeing on how those numbers were used. Calculating with Radun's standard of deviation, the rate is 11 times what it should be, Estrella said in tight tones. Furthermore, this must indicate the intervention of the shadow. Tassan cut her off, beaded braids clicking as she shook her head. The shadow, yes, but Radun's standard, it is outdated. You must use Kovanen's first rule of medians and calculate separately for rotting meat or rotten. The correct answers, as I said, are 13 and 9. I've not yet applied it to the flour or the beans and the lentils, but it seems intuitively obvious. Estrella swelled up, and since she was a plump woman with a formidable bosom, she could swell impressively. Kufanen's first rule? She practically spluttered, breaking in. That hasn't been properly proven yet. Correct and proven methods are always preferable to slipshod. Alviarin very nearly smiled as she moved on. So someone had finally noticed that the Great Lord had laid his hand on the tower. But knowing would not help them change matters. Perhaps she had smiled, but if so, she crushed it as someone spoke. You'd grimace too, Ramisa, if you were being strapped every morning before breakfast, Noreen said, much too loudly, and plainly meaning for Alviarin to hear. Ramisa, a tall, slender woman with silver bells sewn down the sleeves of her white-embroidered dress, looked startled at being addressed, and likely she was. Noreen had few friends, perhaps none. She went on, cutting her eyes toward Alviarin to see whether she had noticed. It is irrational to call a penance private and pretend nothing is happening when the Armelin's seat has imposed it. But then her rationality has always been overrated, in my opinion. Fortunately, Alviarin had only a short way further to reach her rooms. Carefully, she closed the outer door and latched the latch. Not that anyone would disturb her, but she had not survived by taking chances except where she had to. The lamps were lit, and a small fire burned on the white marble hearth against the cool of an early spring evening. At least the servants still performed their duties, but even the servants knew. Silent tears of humiliation began to stream down her cheeks. She wanted to kill Sylviana, yet that would only mean a new mistress of novices laying the strap across her every morning until Elida relented, except that Elida would never relent. Killing her would be more to the point, yet such killings had to be carefully rationed. Too many unexpected deaths would cause questions, perhaps dangerous questions. Still, she had done what she could against Elida. Katarina's news of this battle was spreading through the Black Aja and beyond it already. She had overheard sisters who were not black talking of Dumai's Wells in detail, and if the details had grown in the telling, so much the better. Soon the news from the Black Tower would have diffused through the White Tower, too, likely expanding in the same way. A pity that neither would be sufficient to see Elida disgraced and deposed, with those cursed rebels practically on the bridges. Yet Dumai's Wells and the disaster in Andor hanging over her head would keep her from undoing what Alviarin had done. Break the White Tower from within, she had been ordered. Plant discord and chaos in every corner of the tower. Part of her had felt pain at that command, a part of her still did. yet her greater loyalty was to the Great Lord. Elida herself had made the first break in the tower, but she had shattered half of it past mending. Abruptly, she realized that she was touching her forehead again and snatched her hand down. There was no mark there, nothing to feel or see. Every time she glanced into a mirror, she checked in spite of herself. And yet, sometimes she thought people were looking at her forehead, seeing something that escaped her own eyes. That was impossible, irrational, yet the thought crept in no matter how often she chased it away. Dashing tears from her face with the hand holding the message from the tapestry, she pulled the other two she had retrieved out of her belt pouch and went to the writing table standing against the wall. It was a plain table and unadorned like all of her furnishings, some of which she suspected might be of indifferent workmanship. A trivial matter. So long as furniture did what it was supposed to do, nothing more mattered. Dropping the three messages on the table beside a small beaten copper bowl, she produced a key from her pouch, unlocked a brass-banded chest sitting on the floor beside the table, and sorted through the small leather-bound books inside until she found the three she needed, each protected so that the ink on the pages would vanish if any hand but hers touched them. There were far too many ciphers in use for her to keep them in memory. Losing these books would be a painful trial, replacing them arduous, hence the stout chest and the lock. A very good lock. Good locks were not trivialities. Quickly she stripped off the thin strips of paper wrapping the message recovered from behind the tapestry, held them to a lamp flame and dropped them into the bowl to burn. They were only directions as to where the message was to be left. One meant for each woman in the chain, the extra strips merely a way of disguising how many links the message had to go through to reach its recipient. Too many precautions were an impossibility. Even the sisters of her own heart believed her no more than they. Only three on the Supreme Council knew who she was, and she would have avoided that had it been possible. There could never be too many precautions, especially now. The message, once she worked it out, bending to write on another sheet, was much as she had expected since the previous night when Talene failed to appear. The woman had left the green quarters early yesterday carrying fat saddlebags and a small chest. Not having a servant carry them, she had performed the task herself. No one seemed to know where she had gone. The question was, had she panicked on receiving her summons to the Supreme Council, or was there something more? Something more, Alviarin decided. Talene had looked to Eukiri and Doacene as though seeking guidance, perhaps. She was sure she had not imagined it. Could she have? A very small seed of hope. There must be something more. She needed a threat to the Black, or the Great Lord would withdraw his protection. Angrily, she pulled her hand away from her forehead. She never considered using the small Turangreal she had hidden away to call Messana. For one thing, one very important thing, the woman surely intended to kill her, very likely despite the Great Lord's protection, on the instant, if that protection were lost. She had seen Messana's face, knew of her humiliation. No woman would let that pass, especially not one of the Chosen. Every night she dreamed of killing Messana, often daydreamed of how to manage it successfully, yet that must wait on finding her without the woman knowing herself found. In the meanwhile, she needed more proof. It was possible that neither Messana nor Shaidar Haran would see Talene as verification of anything. Sisters had panicked and run in the past, if rarely, and assuming Messana and the Great Lord were ignorant of that would be dangerous. In turn, she touched the ciphered message and the clear copy to the lamp flame and held each by a corner until they had burned nearly to her fingers, before dropping them atop the ashes in the bowl. With a smooth black stone that she kept as a paperweight, she crushed the ashes and stirred them about. She doubted that anyone could reconstitute words from ash. But even so... Still standing, she deciphered the other two messages and learned that Eukiri and Doacene both slept in rooms warded against intrusion. That was unsurprising. Hardly a sister in the tower slept without warding these days, but it meant kidnapping either would be difficult. That was always easiest when carried out in the depths of the night by sisters of the woman's own Aja. It might yet turn out those glances were happenstance or imagination. She needed to consider the possibility.
With a sigh, she gathered more of the small books from the chest and gently eased herself onto the goose-down cushion on the chair at the writing table. Not gently enough to stop a wince as her weight settled, though. She stifled a whimper. At first, she had thought the humiliation of Sylviana's strap far worse than the pain, but the pain no longer really faded. Her bottom was a mass of bruises, and tomorrow the Mistress of Novices would add to them, and the day after that, and the day after. A bleak vision of endless days howling under Sylviana's strap, of fighting to meet the eyes of sisters who knew all about the visits to Sylviana's study. Trying to chase those thoughts away, she dipped a good steel-nibbed pen and began to write out ciphered orders on thin sheets of paper. Taline must be found and brought back, of course, for punishment and execution, if she had simply panicked, and if she had not, if she had somehow found a way to betray her oaths. Alviarin clung to that hope while she commanded a close watch put on Yukiri and Dorsine. A way had to be found to take them, and if they were caught up in chance and imagination, something could still be manufactured from whatever they said. She would guide the flows in the circle. Something could be made. She wrote furiously, unaware that her free hand had risen to her forehead, searching for the mark.